Paul in the Areopagus, in the midst of his defense of his Christian faith, wants to teach the Athenians about creation and providence as the presuppositions that lie behind his declaration of Christ and the resurrection. It's interesting the way that Paul declares his belief in the creation and God's providence. You'll find in Acts 17, verse 26, "And he made from one every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and boundaries of their habitation." Paul here declares that God has made from one, implied from one man or from one stock, every nation of mankind. Now, it's not often brought out in apologetics textbooks how much of what Paul said was offensive to the Athenians. It's obvious that his declaration of the resurrection was an offense to the Athenians. But if you'll study the philosophy of the Stoics and the philosophy of the Epicureans, as well as the other philosophies then viable in Athens in Paul's day, you'll find that in particular there was a very, very strong racial prejudice against those who were not brought up on Attic soil. And so Paul, when I'm getting across, those of you who've had apologetics for me already know this lecture in a sense, Paul is really, point by point, every statement in the Areopagus address, it turns out, was a direct offense, was a direct challenge to very crucial elements of the philosophies of his day. And here Paul is teaching not only God's creation and providence, but he's teaching it in a way which is very antagonistic to those who felt that if you weren't a native of Attic soil and so forth, that you were really somewhat less than you ought to be. And he says, no, God has made from one all nations that dwell on earth. Now, Paul not only sees the significance of that fact in terms of his apologetic, but he thinks there's some significance to this oneness of the human race also in terms of his theology. In Romans, the fifth chapter, you'll all be aware of the fact, of course, that Paul's drawing a parallel between the federal headship of Jesus Christ and the federal headship of Adam. In verse 16 of Romans 5, we read, "And the gift is not like that which came through the one who sinned. For on the one hand, the judgment arose from one transgression, resulting in condemnation. But on the other hand, the free gift arose from many transgressions, resulting in justification. For if by the transgression of the one death reigned through the one, much more those who receive the abundance of grace and of the gift of righteousness shall reign in life through the one, Jesus Christ." It doesn't take an advanced course in logic to figure out that Paul's argument doesn't hold water at all if the human race is not unified. If there was but two heads of the human race, two different original families, then Paul's point is gone. Not only can he not draw the parallel between Jesus as the one federal head and therefore the only mediator between God and men and the only Savior, not only can he not draw that kind of parallel, but he can't even conclude that all mankind is sold under sin. But he says through the transgression, the one transgression of the one man, we all have death passed to us. All right. And therefore, I won't belabor the fact that the Bible teaches the unity of the human race. That in God's sight, you see, there is but one kind of humanity. And it's a common humanity. That raises then the question of race. And the title of my little discussion this afternoon is The Morality or Perhaps Immorality of Racism. Now, nobody is going to deny the existence of race, as a matter of fact. Racism, however, is not the declaration that there are different races, but that there should be different treatment of different races, or maybe one particular race should be given particularly good treatment or another particular race particularly bad treatment. That is, that there is some discrimination in the way one reacts to a member of another race or even of his own race. That is racism, not the declaration that there are races, but that they should be treated in somehow different ways. And we want to ask ourselves about the moral question, what is the morality of racism? What is the morality? That's the categorical question. And then in the title, as it's been indicated, I'm really going to be talking about the immorality of racism for the most part. That is how, in terms of the general question of the morality of racism, the judgment we must come to is that it is immoral. That is, that it is immoral to treat a member of another race in a way other than what you would treat a member of your own race. God looks upon all of humanity as a common humanity. And I'm going to argue, therefore, any racism is immoral. But before I can make that point, I guess some relevant distinctions will have to be drawn, and in a sense this is going to take up a good deal of the time of our discussion, because, as is the case in a lot of ethical questions, I don't think it's unique to this, but especially in the race question, if you notice the literature, if you listen to the debates or even informal discussions of people about the race issue, you will notice that there are a host of problems being debated at one and the same time. And that the reason progress is not made in Christians coming to one mind about that is because there's the attempt to answer many questions with one answer. That is, people often don't realize that they have merged, they have blurred a number of questions. And so I think by beginning with some relevant distinctions, we'll be able to then systematically answer the question about the morality of racism. And the first distinction that I would draw to your attention is the one drawn in the top left-hand corner over here between internal and external. By which I mean, if you're going to talk about different treatment of a person of another race, you can talk about different external treatment, what you do in terms of your social and public life toward that person, but then there's also the question of the attitude of the heart. Different treatment in the sense of different reaction to and different attitude toward members of another race. All right. Now, if we're going to talk about treatment of different individuals as being moral or immoral, then we of necessity must talk also about sanctions against such behavior. If it's going to be immoral, then there must be sanctions against it. And toward the left of the board underneath that line, there are three general categories of sanctions that we discuss in the realm of morality. The state, obviously, exercises a kind of sanction. The state is the power of the sword, Paul tells us. It has a compulsory power and the power of penal sanction against certain criminals. The church also, while it is an agency of mercy, the proclamation of the gospel, the church also knows about penal sanctions. Paul tells the church at Corinth that they are to excommunicate a man who is guilty of incest, and that this excommunication is turning that man over so that his flesh might be destroyed in the realm of Satan. Excommunication, admonition, and a number of other features of the life of a consistory or a session, or even a presbytery, express church penology, or the discipline of the church. So there is that. And then finally, of course, we don't believe that the state and the church cover all moral offenses. They often don't cover many of them, really. In fact, every moral offense will be redressed in the final day by God. That there is eternal penal sanction, there's eternal punishment for all sin as well. So now when we talk about racism and the morality or immorality of it, we want to know whether we're talking about a racist attitude or a racist public behavior. We want to know whether it's going to be punished by the state, by the church, or by God eternally. And then finally, when we talk about racism, we have to recognize that there are different areas of life that racism comes to expression in. Those areas of life are conveniently summarized. I'm not saying that there aren't different category schemes you could use. We'd make the same points, however, if you change the categories. But I think a convenient way of doing it is to recognize that there is a sphere called the state, a sphere called the church, a sphere called the family, and there's also a sphere of private enterprise, by which I mean, although that's couched in economic language, I'm really talking about all those public endeavors that one engages in voluntarily and for whatever, you know, motivation. In economics, it may mean to gain capital, a resource, or it may be for a social intercourse, whatever it is. But all those enterprises of society which one enters into, not of necessity, but privately, that is by his own free will. We all are members of families, and you don't choose that. And unless you happen to be born in a very unusual time of history, you're all in some way or some manner or other engaged in the state. And those who are Christians are by definition members of Christ's church. And I won't get into the theological issue about, you know, joining the visible church over the invisible, but everybody will grant that it's impossible by definition to be a Christian and not be a member of Christ's body, Christ's church. However, in private enterprise, this is something which some Christians enter into, some unbelievers enter into, some family units enter into, and it's really a question of what a man wishes to do with his life and his resources. All right, so I think this covers all the areas, basically. If you want to be more refined, as I've said, you can do that too. But we want to ask a question about discriminatory treatment and reaction to members of a race other than your own, whether it be internal or external, whether it be expressed in the state, the church, the family, or private enterprise, and whether it be redressed by the state, the church, or eternally redressed. And before we get into now, just taking up each one of these categories and trying to fill in the slot as to what our Christian reaction should be, I want to encourage you to see what we're going to be talking about today as very important, not simply for the obvious social reason that racism is a difficulty in our society and a number of societies throughout the world today, but it's especially important in light of the sixth commandment that we are not to engage in murder. You know how Jesus teaches us in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew the fifth chapter, that a man who has a grudge, an offense against his brother, or knows that his brother has an offense against him, is to not approach God in worship, is not to bring his sacrifice to the altar, is not to continue his religious exercises and duties until he's gone and he has made that right. Jesus also teaches us that when we have improper attitudes, anger, unrighteous wrath toward our brothers, that we are engaging in murder. We are violating the sixth commandment. And so it's especially important for Christians this day to get the race issue set straight. In one sense, one might want to argue, although there are other considerations I'm not going into now, one might want to argue that there is a real necessity, if our religious worship is going to be acceptable in God's sight, for us to get the race issue taken care of, at least in the Christian church. We've got to be concerned with this, because if we aren't, it's not just a social blight. It's not just something inconvenient in our society, but it is a direct violation of the sixth commandment, that we are engaging in murderous practices, as much as it's not rare, I mean, it's rarely put that way to you. I think in biblical categories, it's murderous when we don't have a proper attitude toward race, when we encourage improper attitudes between the races and therefore set offenses and breaches between us. And I think in the words of Jesus, our religious worship can't really very credibly and with integrity be engaged in until that has been settled. All right, so much for why it's important and so much for the distinctions. Let's get down systematically now to some answers. And I hope to kind of conclude this fairly early this afternoon, because I think it'd be valuable to have an opportunity to interact with what I'm going to say and get either your criticisms or questions for clarification. All right, systematically, we want to ask about one's internal attitude, one's external attitude toward a member of another race. So let's talk about the internal attitude first of all. Paul teaches us as Christians that we are each to esteem the other higher than himself. Now, to take that seriously means to stop and think, how do I treat somebody that I think of much, you know, higher than myself? Obviously, I do not discriminate such a person. In fact, I hope such a person will show favor toward me. I respect such a person. I put him on a pedestal. I consider him better than myself. I don't discriminate against him. I don't think lowly of him. I think just the opposite. Paul says that we are each to consider the other higher than himself. For after all, didn't Jesus himself become humble, humiliate himself even to the point of the cross? All humanity is one common humanity, and we're each to esteem the other higher than himself. Internally, we have no justification for a racist attitude. For if you take a racist attitude, that person toward whom you discriminate in your attitude, as you think lowly of him, that person, well, just that, has been thought of in a manner which is unbecoming of a Christian. However, externally, the issue is an important one when we get to these various areas that have been delineated on the board, the state, the church, the family, and private enterprise. What do I do in a public way, not just what my attitude may be, but what do I do externally, publicly, toward members of another race in these areas? And I'll start with the state, first of all, and just point out a few passages to get the point across in a bare way. Leviticus, the 19th chapter, verse 15, teaches us how the state is to look upon race. Leviticus 19, verse 15 says, well, that's not it, is it? I'm sorry, I've got the wrong reference. Let me see if I can find it quick, but if not, we'll go to the next one. In verse 21, you have established that you are not to have different treatments of different people, and that you can't show pity in the case of a criminal. I think that's worth noting here, that one can't say, this man has committed an offense, and he gets the punishment, but this man has committed the same offense, and I'll show him pity. Now, turn to the reference before I give it to you this time. Well, in Leviticus 19:15, what we have is, you shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. And then in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 17, we read, you shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall hear the small and the great alike. You shall not show partiality in judgment. Then Deuteronomy 16, verse 19, repeats the injunction. You shall not distort justice, you shall not be partial, and you shall not take a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Now it's interesting that the Hebrew idiom for being partial is to look upon the face. Look upon the face. And you shall not look upon the face. You shall not show respect to persons. You shall not be partial. Consequently, impartial treatment, impartial justice is called for on the part of the state toward men of all races. And of course, the Bible throughout the Old Testament enjoins upon us our duties to those who are helpless. How much more must impartial treatment be given to those who, because of bad attitudes of other individuals, are put in an inferior social position or a helpless social position? Deuteronomy 27, verse 19 says, cursed is he who distorts the justice due to an alien, an orphan, or a widow, and all the people shall say, so be it. In Jeremiah 22, verse 3, we find these words, Thus saith the Lord, do justice and righteousness, and deliver the one who has been robbed from the power of his oppressor. Also, do not mistreat or do violence to the stranger, to the orphan, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place. So in conclusion, the state cannot be an area in which racism is expressed. There must be no respect of persons, no looking upon the face, no different treatment, no pity to one man, but exacting the punishment on another. In fact, we are to be totally without consideration of race when it comes to the state. Well, how about the church? Can there be a discriminatory policy within the Church of Jesus Christ? Now, those who talk about the race problem in the church often turn to Ephesians, the second chapter, and rightly so, to get some principles here where Paul teaches that the racist attitude of the Jews is wrong in God's sight because the Gentiles and the Jews have been brought together in the one body of Jesus Christ, that the enmity has been slain, has been broken down, symbolically in the breaking down of the wall of partition that between the area that the Gentiles had come into and then beyond which only the Jews could go at the temple. Now, if Jew and Gentile are to put aside their differences and to be brought into one body, and one of the most racist attitudes you could ask for in history is expressed by the Jews and the Judaizers of Paul's day, then how much more, of course, things that are not based on religious differences, but just differences of color of skin or national origin, how much more shall these lesser things be put aside in order that all people would be brought together into the one body of Jesus Christ? Now, I say often people, you'll hear that argument, and I think it's a good argument, it's a valid one, but I'd like to add to that today something which strikes me as even a little more pungent and strong. We're talking about the church and whether a man of another race could come, join the church, worship with the church, whether the church should show one attitude toward him, another attitude toward people of another race. the first thing I'd like to begin and set before you for consideration is to say that to bar a man from your church is, wittingly or unwittingly, to bar a man from the communion of the saints and from the Lord's table at that church. When you say that a man cannot worship with you, you obviously exclude him from partaking of the Lord's Supper with you. And in fact, I would maintain we should always be taking the Lord's Supper. I favor a weekly communion, but that's not the issue today. Even those who hold to a quarterly or yearly communion would have to grant that in principle, a man who can't come to my church can't come and take communion on that Sunday either. And so to bar a man from your church is to bar that man from the communion of the saints and from the Lord's table. Now we have to ask ourselves, those who are given the authority to exercise the keys of the kingdom, on what grounds does the Scripture allow barring a man from the Lord's table? There are grounds. It turns out they are twofold. We can prevent a man from partaking of communion, of the Lord's Supper, when, one, there has been no profession of faith publicly, that is, when the man has not joined himself to the church, or two, when a man who is a member of the church is under discipline for unrepentant sin. So unbelievers and unrepentant sinners who profess belief are not allowed at the Lord's table. These are the only grounds that I know of in Scripture for keeping a man from approaching the holy table. And thus it turns out that the de facto excommunication of a man not of your race, that is the de facto telling him that he cannot come to your communion table, cannot come to the Lord's table, that de facto excommunication of a man on the basis of his race, not on the basis of his profession, not on the basis of his unrepentant sin, is in effect to declare either that this man is sinful because of his race, or that we are not exercising the keys of the kingdom, but rather abusing the keys of the kingdom, and thereby are guilty of abuse of the Lord's table ourselves. That is, when you keep somebody from the Lord's table who belongs at the Lord's table, then you abuse the table. When you allow a man who doesn't belong at the Lord's table to the table, then you allow him to abuse the table. And so in every case, when a man is barred from the table, you must ask whether abuse is involved, and in every case when a man comes, whether abuse is involved. Now what I'm saying is you're on the horns of a dilemma then if you don't let a man who is not a member of your race partake of the Lord's Supper at your church. For either you declare his race to be sinful, because that's the ground upon which he's been barred from your church, or you declare that you are abusing the Lord's table because you will go beyond the provisions of Scripture in saying who can have communion and who cannot in your church. And so externally, I don't believe that the church can be an expression of racism either. There can be no discrimination within the Christian church. Now we come to the family, and it's in this area especially that I think there might be some controversy and some disagreement over what I'm going to teach. But it would seem obvious to many people that when we talk about the external relationships of families, that there is to be discrimination after all. And what I mean by that is that you can't form a family on the basis of an interracial union, that a man of one race and a woman of another should not be joined together. That is, the family should then be an external expression of racial discrimination. Not that you don't judge, for instance, that a Negro family is just as much a family as a white family is a family. What I'm saying is that the very constitution of the family must express racial discrimination. There ought to be no interracial marriage, to put it very plainly. Well, you know that the feelings run pretty high in that sort of an issue. I'm hesitant, of course, to even address it for that reason. But let me just say in advance, to those who are going to disagree what I'm going to say here, that let's be good brothers and sisters in Christ and disagree, one, in a good spirit, and secondly, with the attitude of edifying one another. And so if I'm mistaken, I want you to know that I'm teachable, I'm willing to see what the Scripture teaches on this point that I've overlooked, and I'll certainly correct my opinion if you show me. But when it comes to the family, it seems to me God's Word does tell us on what basis you can discriminate in the forming of a family. Just as with the church, you can discriminate toward individuals. Of course, the basis of a discrimination is the man's an unbeliever or he's an unrepentant sin. In the family, there can be discrimination as well. But it seems to me that the grounds of the discrimination in Old Testament and in New Testament are religious grounds. They are religious grounds. Now, the difficulty is in the Old Testament because Israel was not to intermarry with her heathen neighbors. Many people feel that that's a national discrimination. But in each case that I know of, the Bible clearly explains that they are not to intermarry with other cultures because of religious problems. That is, you are not to join a Hebrew, a man who has been redeemed by God, one who's committed to the covenant Lord Jehovah, with someone who is not. In fact, in the cases of those outside the nation of Israel, outside the culture of Israel, who do come into Israel and who do profess allegiance to Jehovah, they enter into marriage contracts in Israel, and that's perfectly all right. So I'm not going to belabor the point lest we run out of discussion time. Obviously, even in the Old Testament, it was for religious reasons that there was discrimination within the family. Of course, Paul teaches us, as you all know, that we aren't to be unequally yoked together, and other passages that teach perhaps even more clearly that a Christian and a non-Christian are not to marry. So there is to be a form of discrimination in the constitution of families. But I dare say that form of discrimination is never racial in the Bible. That the people that I cannot marry, that class of people, that set of people, is never defined in racial terms. Always defined in religious terms. And in fact, we even have an example in the Bible, it seems to me, of an interracial marriage, and certainly not an example, just some minor peripheral event, but in Numbers, the 12th chapter, we read that Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. Now, although those who don't believe in interracial marriage have labored long and hard to try to disprove the point and have done so unsuccessfully, I believe, there's no way that you can avoid seeing that Cush is the land of Ethiopia. And everybody knows that the Ethiopians are Negroid. Now somebody says, yes, but that all depends upon your ancient, you know, archaeology and your sociology and so forth. You can't prove that point. Well, I don't know. If you mean I can't persuade the person of the point, maybe I can't. But if you'll turn to Jeremiah, the 13th chapter, verse 33, you'll find this very interesting statement by the prophet. Jeremiah 13:33. Well, I'll tell you, this isn't my day. That isn't the passage either. The 23 I wanted? Thank you. Yes. Can the Ethiopian change his skin? Can the leopard change his spots? And of course, the point being made here has nothing to do with race, but rather whether you can change that which you are. You know, you can't, those who are accustomed to doing evil can't do good. But the example is that of the Cushite, the Ethiopian. The Ethiopian that Moses married was not a member of his own race, as you understand race, by color of the skin. And his brother and sister were appalled that he should do it. Of course, the judgment of God fell on his brother and sister in that very context. Of course, there's debate over whether it was that issue or whether Moses, in his privileged position as a prophet of God, and their jealousy toward that position, was the reason for the judgment. But the fact remains that one of the mightiest, in fact, perhaps in the Old Testament, the greatest of the leaders of God's people, certainly the one for whom Jesus Christ is the antitype, was engaged in an interracial marriage. So I'm arguing that interracial marriage, apart from, you know, all sorts of pragmatic questions about what that would do in our society and so forth and so on, and how it should be entered and all that, I mean, we may want to get to that in discussion. The fact is that it's not immoral. The Bible does not present grounds to charge a man with immorality for marrying a woman of another race.
This is the end of Side 1. The message is continued on Side 2. You need not rewind the tape. Simply turn the cassette over and begin Side 2.
And so externally, there's to be no racial discrimination in state, in church, in family. How about private enterprise? Now, this may be a change of direction in a sense, because what I'm saying is that racism is immoral in the state, the church, and the family. And I believe that racism is immoral in private enterprise as well. However, I don't believe it's illegal. And so now another distinction enters into the question. By legality, we mean that which, in terms of a system of social rules, legality is that which is right and just, those things with respect to which men have duties. that is the proper domain of the civil magistrate. Can the civil magistrate enact a law where a man cannot show discrimination as to race in his own private enterprises? Can the state compel me in the enterprises of my life, my social enterprises, to react toward a member of another race in the same way as I do to my own race? If I own a restaurant, can the state compel me to use my private property and my enterprise toward everybody in a similar fashion? Now, I'm going to argue that no, the state cannot. That it is not illegal for a man to discriminate with respect to social enterprises. Now, notice, we've already talked about the state. If your social enterprise is, in fact, something that's licensed by the state or run by the state, something like that, then there must be impartiality. The magistrate cannot show, you know, respect of persons. So we're not talking about anything that has to do with the state and the privileges of a citizen of the state and all of its functions. We're talking about what I, with respect to my own property, my own free decisions and social interaction, have to do in the eyes of the magistrate. And what I'm arguing is that if you want to guard the obvious teaching of the Eighth Commandment, you must guard private enterprise and the right of a man to do that which he wants with his own. Of course, there are qualifications, aren't there? A man can't do just anything he wants with his own. There's, I may own a car, and since it's my car, I have a right to give a ride in my car to whomever I will. So in that sense, the state can't say anything to me. But now, the speed with which I drive my car, whether I run over people with my car, I can't do just anything I want in that sense. So what's the difference? The difference is, in terms of what a man does in a positive fashion with his property, must not violate other commandments of God, destroying human life or being unsafe, whatever it is. But in terms of his offering of his privately owned goods and his own social functions, offering these to the benefit of other people, that is something that's under his free control, and the state cannot tell him whom he can benefit and whom he cannot. And so to guard the Eighth Commandment in private enterprise, I think we have to say that it's not illegal for a man to express a racist attitude as he runs his restaurant or drives his car, whatever it may be. But now that I've said that, don't forget the first statement. It's nevertheless immoral to do so. It is immoral to do so. When we're talking about legality, we're in this narrow sense, now that as I've defined it, we're talking about what the civil magistrate can punish, what the civil magistrate can compel. And I'm saying that the civil magistrate cannot compel me to use my money in the way I want to use my money, or to open my shop in the way I want to open my shop. And that brings us finally then back to the left-hand side of the board, under the line, the three kinds of sanctions. In denying the illegality of racism in private enterprise, all I'm saying is the state cannot enter into that domain and enforce a non-discriminatory attitude and reaction on my part. But notice that that isn't all the penal sanctions that we talk about as Christians and in ethics. There's the church, and certainly the eternal punishment of God to be considered. And here, the church, looking upon the immorality of my attitude when I will not serve a Negro in my restaurant, can clearly call me before the session, try to edify me, rebuke, reinforce that. Eventually, I dare say the church could even excommunicate if the man is sinning in not allowing another man to be served in his restaurant. That is that racist attitude, the internal sin that we began with this afternoon. That internal sin is something which can be redressed by the church. Church discipline would be appropriate, but state discipline would not. And clearly, if church discipline is appropriate, then how much more the eternal discipline? And I think we should draw that to the attention of people who exercise their legal prerogative to discriminate, to say that is your legal right before the eyes of the magistrate, but it is not your moral right before the eyes of God. And in the long run, you may get away with it in society, but you will never get away with it in the kingdom of God and with respect to the final judgment. Well, I began by saying I think the race discussion is often very confused and confusing because people fail to draw relevant distinctions. I've said that the issue is important because the whole question of our obedience to the Sixth Commandment and the appropriateness and integrity of our worship is tied up with the racism of our society. And then I've said that if we'll break down things into their relevant distinctions in this way and go through the various boxes, if you will, and fill them in, we can systematically see that internal racism is always wrong. We see we must always esteem another higher than ourselves, and in fact, God has made of one stock, of one man, the whole human race. So internally, there is not to be a racist attitude. Externally, there is to be no racism in the state, which shows impartiality in judgment. Externally, no racism in the church, which cannot bar a man from the Lord's table on the basis of anything but sin and unbelief. Externally, there is to be no racism with respect to the family, for the only discrimination in the constitution of families is religious discrimination. Externally, there can be, in one sense, racism with respect to private property in the eyes of the state, in the eyes of the magistrate, but it is nevertheless immoral in the eyes of the church and the eyes of God for all eternity. So now, having drawn those distinctions, what I'd like to do is to open up the floor to you challenge whatever of the, you know, those positions you feel needs to be challenged, or raise arguments that you would like to be addressed, or ask questions for clarification. Yeah.
You said in the realm of private enterprise that it could be legal to defend
social legality, right.
But it would be immoral. Why would this not also be true with the state?
Well, because we have specific injunctions in the law of God that there's to be no looking upon the face, no partiality, no respect of persons in the state. That is, in state agencies, the state must treat all of its citizens alike. In fact, it's even to treat foreigners in the same way. And so there's absolutely no grounds for discrimination in the state. You know, the ancient symbol of justice being, you know, the woman who is blindfolded. That's a Christian concept. In terms of the magistrate, he doesn't look upon the face at all. He could be blind and he would still render the same judgment, ideally. The law of God requires that. So that's what I mean. In terms of official state functions, our laws, justice, law courts, there's to be no discrimination. Every man's treated alike. In my ethics class, we've been going over this very thing. There are really two questions there. First of all, do we believe the state is obligated to enforce the law of God? Now, that's the broad and basic fundamental question. Because there are plenty of people, plenty of Christian people, who teach today that the state is really outside that realm altogether. We're in a pluralistic society. The state can do whatever it wants. I don't believe that. In fact, I've written an entire book against that point of view. I believe the state is obligated to keep the law of God. But now, having answered that, there's the second question. What portion of Christian morality, or what portion of the law of God, applies to the state? The state cannot punish me for covetousness. The Bible clearly teaches the magistrate punishes offenses of the hand, not of the heart. The state cannot punish me for adultery of the heart, hatred of the heart, but it clearly can punish me for adultery of the body and murder with the hand. And so you must see that it's maybe a portion of Christian morality that we are not to engage in racism. And the church, and of course God's eternal punishment, will come to bear on that. But that doesn't mean the state has the right to engage in every act of morality. There's a difference between social legality, justice, and rights, publicly speaking, and Christian morality, the whole scope, inclusive of what the state should do, but private morality as well. And no, I would argue, although I haven't presented that argument here, just to fill in for your question, I would argue that the state cannot enforce an attitude and cannot enforce a particular treatment or use of my own privately owned property. Now, believe me, I reprobate and have no brief for people who will not serve Negroes or members of the other race. I mean, discrimination works both ways. But my point is, I cannot go in and say, you will use your money and your property and your services in a way contrary to your free will. Unless, of course, you're using it in this positive sense of trying to hurt other people. If you're trying to run over people with your car, then you can be stopped. But you can certainly refuse a ride to anybody you see fit to refuse a ride to, legally, in the eyes of the state. And so, yes, the magistrate is to enforce morality, as long as you understand that the magistrate cannot enforce all morality. The reason he can't do that is because there's a difference between God and the image of God serving as the magistrate. Yeah. Yeah. Well, as in all legal and moral questions of that nature, let's go back to our principles and see how the principles are to be applied, if we agree that the principles are there. And what we've said is, in the realm of private enterprise, the state cannot enforce integration of services. If it's a state function, they must, because there can be no partiality. And therefore, if a busing system is the function of the city, then there can be no discrimination on the buses. If it's a private busing system, say like taxi cabs or something like that, then there could be. Of course, that doesn't change the fact that it's just economically absurd to discriminate. I mean, that's the very reason you're in business, is to get people to ride on your buses or taxi cabs or whatever. It doesn't change the fact that in the eyes of the church and the elders of the church, you should be disciplined for it. But legally, the state cannot force you to use your taxi cab or your privately owned bus, you know, to serve people you don't want to serve. Because one is the offering of a voluntary service, and the other is the you're in encroachment upon the other man's life. In other words, within my own domain, within my own sphere, my own life, I can have whatever attitude, legally again, not morally in the eyes of God, but legally before the magistrate, I can do what I want with my own, but I can't use my own to hurt another person. And you say, but now how about the withholding of help to another person? I mean, there you're hurting him, but that's not a sin of commission. That is taking, you know, your axe and going over and hitting the guy. But it's a sin of omission, failing to offer him, you see, a bowl of soup when he's dying. Now, we haven't gotten into that simply for the reason that that's really a legal question that affects all of Christian morality, and it doesn't make any difference on the race issue there. And what I would say briefly, I don't want to get into that particular issue, I believe that there are cases where the withholding of help is in fact an illegal act. No. That's... Well, of course, in this case, we can talk about what is the system right now and what ought to be the system. In an ideal system, no. Because we wouldn't have laws that the guilt or innocence of a person is predicated upon his motivation. We'd have laws that allowed for the state to do what it can do, and that's judge the outward act. Of course, we do now have laws that judge motivation, and in that case we can say it's legal for the state to do it, but that legal system ought to be reformed. And that's why it's kind of interesting to hear Richard Nixon say that he wasn't guilty of the crimes alleged against him because his motivation was all right. Well, you see, he may have a point in terms of the de facto laws of this country. I haven't read the statutes. I assume as a lawyer he read it and he knows. I'll tell you this, if it were God's law being enforced in this society, it wouldn't make a bit of difference. Because his motivation may be good, it may be bad. See, the same holds true for men who do good acts. Men do good acts for poor motivation too. But the state doesn't thereby punish them because they say, well, yeah, you did a nice thing, but your motivation was wrong. The state in no sense can be a reader of the heart. Only God can do that, and so the state should judge the external acts of a man. Why do you think that's the case? Can you think of an example? That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see what you're getting at now. You see, when you asked about motivation, I took you in the technical sense. What we're really talking about there is premeditation. You see, is this an act that arises from the situation, that is an act of passion and so forth? I mean, maybe, you know, even in an act of passion, I could kill a man for a good motivation. I mean, strange scenario to be written there, but you could imagine such a thing. That is not technically motivation. That's a question of whether the man had plotted in advance to do this. That is, whether it was something that he did on the spur of the moment, an act of passion, accidentally even, or whether he did it because he had intended to do it. And that's not technically, that is not in jurisprudence a question of motivation. It's a question of whether it was premeditated. Yeah, but I agree with you. Such questions like that have to be you know, even by the law of God, there's a difference between the treatment of a man who accidentally has his axe head fly off and kill somebody, and then somebody who knows the axe head is loose and goes out and chops anyway. Yeah, you have to know that. But you see, in judging those things, you don't, in a sense, judge the man's spirit. You judge according to the circumstances, whether there was motivation or irresponsibility. I mean, not, I'm muddying the waters here. Whether there's premeditation or irresponsibility. So you ask, you know, is there any evidence that this man knew his axe head was weak? And a man out chopping with him may be the one who gives the evidence. Yeah, it flew off last week too, you know, or something like that. Or in the case of a goring ox, you know, this man knew he had an unsafe ox because it's gored before and he never put the pin around it. So premeditation, irresponsibility, things like that are judged. I don't mean to exclude that. I'm talking specifically about what motivates a man in either his responsible, irresponsible, meditated, premeditated, you know, acts. Yeah, if your point is that it's a fuzzy line, then I'm not interested to dispute it. It certainly is. Just like there's a fuzzy line between friendship and, you know, just acquaintances. And, I mean, there are fuzzy lines throughout our lives, but we believe there are lines. Drawing them isn't the point. The point is whether there is a difference in the sight of God. It's kind of hard to, you know, to define pornography, too. I mean, to draw the lines legally. But I think we all know there is a difference between, you know, promiscuous and non-promiscuous uses of the body and portrayal of the body. Private enterprise. If you have a borderline, see, if you're thinking of a borderline case between the domain of the state and the domain of private enterprise, then you're getting close to what you're talking about in your metaphor of the fuzzy line. That's right. But in terms of trying to teach what our attitude should be, when you can see which category it falls in, then we can see where the state has gone too far or where it's not gone far enough. The funny thing is, the state that today so proclaims the intent to take care of a racist attitude, instead of taking care of racism as the law of God sees it so clearly in the state, that is the way the judicial system runs, which is just appalling racial injustice done there. Instead of taking care of that, what we do is we try to take care of racism in areas that are not even the domain of the state by trying to tell people who you can serve and who you can, you know, that sort of thing. It's kind of an interesting the state's abandoned its proper domain as it starts encroaching upon others. But I'll grant that I could imagine drawing a scenario where it's hard to tell where the state's responsibility stops and where the private enterprise or the right of a man to do things begins. Just like it's kind of hard to tell, you know, this question about whether I have the right to refuse rent to a person. Although I believe that a man legally has that right, I know the argument and I understand the premises of the argument and can see the thrust of it. Well, but you see, if everybody did that, you would be destroying his life. He had no shelter. The whole point of that is that there are a lot of other ethical issues there. What if everybody did the same? That whole line of ethics has got to be ferreted out and so forth and so on. So I'm granting that there can be real questions. The point is, before you can get on to the ambiguous issues, you'd better know what the clear principles are. And so you draw them clearly, and then you start dealing, you try to reduce the fuzziness at the seams. I grant there are fuzzy seams, probably always will be, till the Lord returns. Well, we're over time, but I'm glad to take maybe another question or two. Okay. if it's all right with you, let me rewrite the argument in its more stringent form. The argument goes something like this in the literature. That a man, use the restaurant example, a man who wants to open a restaurant has got to get a permit to do so. He's got to be zoned properly to have a restaurant. Now, to get the zone, the zoning, the man, in essence, enters into a contract with the state declaring his intention to serve the public. When the man then has the restaurant and does not serve the public impartially, he has violated his contract by which he got the zoning permit, and therefore the state can step in. Now, interestingly, there's two points to be made about that. Interestingly, first of all, strictly speaking, the man, if that's the argument, I don't really believe that's what goes on in terms of, you know, as this civil rights thing in this country has developed, that it wasn't really on that kind of argument. But those who argue behind the scenes to so forth, that's about the best you can do with it. And it looks pretty good. In fact, apart from one assumption, I buy that. But the difficulty is, even if you buy the assumption, I'll challenge in a second, the man is not really being punished by the state for his racist attitude. You realize that's the trigger, that's the occasion. On that rationale, which has been offered by some people, he's being punished for his violation of a contract. That is, I enter into a contract with the state when I say, if you'll zone me for as a restaurant, I'll serve the public. And so you see, you can ruin the illustration by simply saying, imagine a society where the man enters into a contract that is gets zoning, saying, I don't intend to serve the public. Now, what if he omits any discussion of that sort of thing? Now, maybe there'll be states where they won't allow him to have a zoning permit on that basis, but you can imagine it. And so therefore, the moral issue is not settled by it. But now, getting secondly to the assumption that is questionable in that, the assumption is that the state ever has the right to zone me for a restaurant or not when it's my private property. You see, the whole issue of the Eighth Commandment, in a sense, has been forgotten by that scenario. Because not only is it a question of whether I can serve whom I want to serve legally, you all know that it's immoral and the church should do something about it, but legally, not only can I serve whom I want to serve, but if it's my property, I have a right to have a restaurant if I want, provided I don't violate the laws of the state that protect people. For instance, health laws. I don't run it in such a way that I'm, encroaching on another man's safety or his life and things like that. If you grant that the state can tell you whether you have the right or not to do what you want with your own, you've already conceded the point that is later to be decided as to whether you can serve whom you want. You've already given up your right of private property at that point implicitly. And so it only follows naturally that in the very writing of that scenario, those who have legally argued for the state's intervention have written right into the scenario the state's intervention by saying the state has the right to license who will give haircuts or who will run buses or who will do this or that or the other. Now another, this is changing it now, so change gears a second. Another way in which that's dealt with is to say that the state can use its injunctions with respect to health codes or driver's licenses and things of that nature to punish people who discriminate. Because that's very immoral, I think. It's immoral for the state to move against the man's restaurant or against his taxi cab company or something, depriving him of a license or saying he's violating health code, when in fact the state is mad or upset, or people in the state are upset that he's discriminating as to who he serves. Now, if the issue is going to be you're discriminating as to who you serve, let's not have this facade that he's really violating a health code or his driver's license is to be revoked. And so I don't think that's going to help the issue. I think we have to stick right to the point. Does the state have the right to tell me who I can serve? In areas where the state does legitimately license, I can imagine some, I think it has the right to say you are to serve the public. That's why we license you, is to protect the public. But I'm not willing to say the state really has the right to tell me what I can do with my private property. That really is not so much a difference of opinion as to the morality of it, but just a question of how legally the agency of compulsion can enter into it. The state may not enter in such a case, but I'd be one of the first people to advocate the church doing so.